surprised to learn that a connection existed between us, however faint.
What did you expect?
Lady Michaela asked, sitting on her bed. She had traded in her beautiful blue and green dress for a silk robe more suitable for sleep. Even the woman's underclothes were stunning. The rough chemise I had brought along looked ungainly and coarse in comparison. The bond between an Asha and her familiar is strong and difficult to break. You'll learn more once we return to Kion.
What's going to happen tomorrow?
The woman took something round and carefully wrapped in paper from her pouch. When she pulled back the sheets, I saw a black stone, crumbled and decayed and covered in mold.
This is a bezoar, she told me. When fresh, it is a powerful antidote to many illnesses. But in a few days' time, not even ashes shall remain. Tomorrow, we shall bring back a fresh specimen.
She slid into her bed, took a quick glance back at me.
You may ask me any other questions you have in mind. You must have many.
I could see the colors of the villager's heart glass changing. I've never noticed that before.
Using the dark runes for the first time made you more attuned to magic. That is all. Most people know three kinds of Asha, Tia. The first are performing Asha, known for their dancing and their singing, though their magic may be weaker than others. The second are fighting Asha, known for their magic and their prowess, though they may not be the most gracious of hosts. The third are dark Asha like us, the strongest of them all.
Does this make my sisters Asha as well?
Your siblings can sense magic, but purple hearts prove they are not powerful enough to be even the weakest of Asha. They make for good apothecaries and ateliers, that is true, but they cannot harness magic strong enough to shape it according to their will. Asha means two things in old runic. The first is truth. The second, spellbinder. That is what we must do. We bind the magic and force it to do as we command. Rose may be a good healer, but she cannot see illnesses in heart's glass. And Lilac may be a good diviner, but she is not strong enough to summon so much as fire. They can draw heart's rune, but that remains the extent of their abilities.
Do you not find it odd that it is the custom of even the most remote villages to wear heart's glass? When my parents wedded, they exchanged them as proof of their love. They have never lost their hearts in the 20 years since their marriage.
My eyes betrayed me. They wandered to Lady Michaela's neck, to her empty heart's glass. I jerked my gaze away, but already Lady Michaela's smile grew pinched, like she had tasted something tartar than runeberries. For a moment, she looked so sad that I worried I had given offense yet again. But she only said,
"Then that is evidence of your parents' fidelity." But one of the original purposes of Heart's Glass was to find people who can wield the magic to take them to be trained. And then there are the rare few like you, who do not wait until they are 13 years old to make their presence known. It was only by a stroke of luck that I was at the right place and time to sense the dark you drew to summon Fox. You would have fared worse otherwise.
I worked at my courage. Lady Michaela, what happened to your heart's glass? Her silence was the only reply I received. She turned and blew out the candles, and the room was plunged into darkness. I lay in bed and listened to the rustle of her clothes, the squeak of the mattress as it settled beneath her. When she spoke again, her words rang out like steel hammers.
That is enough questions for tonight. We rise early tomorrow.
It was not easy to fall asleep in strange surroundings.
I missed my small bed and my little house in Knight's Cross. And already I missed my family. I thought about the heart's glass my parents wore. About the hearts Daisy was constantly losing.
Now that I knew the truth, I couldn't help but feel cheated.
Her explanation of them sounded so commonplace, less exciting than my books led me to believe.
And I was to be an Asha. After everything that had happened, I had little time to appreciate my situation. All my childish play at pretending to be the famous Asha of my stories now felt ridiculous.
Did Taki of the Silk and Nadine of the Whispers feel his way?
I wondered. Were they uprooted from the families they loved and sent to unfamiliar places because the magic that brought them their fame first gave them no choice? I fell asleep with those melancholy thoughts. In the midst of my strange circumstances, Fox's quiet presence in my mind was reassuring. Dead as he was the only familiar thing I had left.
The wind blew heavy pockets of sand across the beach, blanketing everything with grit and ground, but the grave remained pristine, free of mud and soil. The girl knelt, polished a heavy stone at the head of the tomb. She watered the small, budding flowers that sprouted up along the green edges. What do people say of me? They believe that you have turned fully to the dark, my lady, that you have joined the ranks of the faceless, and that you are preparing to lead the people of the lie to war. And do you believe them? I chose honesty. I do not know, my lady. I cannot blame you. The three who claim to lead the faceless also draw in the dark. Most cannot tell us apart. Usijj leads the southern faction. He makes a fortress out of the mountains in Denoris and calls himself king, but he is all bark and bluster. Druj is wilier. He sows his discord in the west, and all city-states in Yadosha would pay a dear amount of money for his head. And as for Aina, the last leader... She pauses. A curious, bitter smile is on her lips. Not much is known about her, save that she originally hailed from Tresea. Mistress Tia, I asked, who is buried here? The grass stained her dress as she lay beside the grave, laid her cheek against the ground. Sadly, she said, a boy who died for me.
4. The small mound lay 20 miles away from Mirkwick, hidden in the woods. There were no paths, and it seemed like you could find that exact spot only if you knew it was there to begin with. This creature used to haunt these woods undeterred for many years, killing stray villagers, Lady Michaela said. Until an Asha who lived over 100 years ago realized it was a Deva and put an end to its rampage. I harvest its stomach frequently, as I travel to this part of Odalia often. Even dead, however, it can be dangerous. I learned this the hard way, when I was much younger. My shoulder still aches when the weather grows cold.
Its stomach...
I stared at the mound with growing nervousness and fear. Fox crouched beside the knoll, his eyes strangely eager. His hand played with the hilt of the sword strapped to his waist.
Keep your distance, Fox,
Lady Michaela told him. She drew out the decaying bezoar and set it down on a large rock.
There is no telling what it may do.
All the more reason to keep near,
he replied.
I have seen Deva before, and I have read as much of them as Tia has. I know what to expect.
There are many things they leave out of books.
And learning about them in stories and learning through experience are two different things. And as I recall, you did not fare so well in the latter.
The Asha drew out a thin knife, and, to my shock, made a small nick on her forefinger.
Take Tia behind those trees. You will not wish to view this Deva up close. And whatever you do, do not look into its eyes.
I tugged at Fox's sleeve without waiting for him to obey. As Fox led me away, she sketched out a strange rune in the air with her cut finger. The blood trailed after her movements. Rather than drip onto the ground, it remained suspended, painting the symbol she drew red and pulsing, as if it had a life of its own. The wind crackled around me, and I felt the small clearing charge with unseen energy, enough to make my hair stand on end. I understood how the Asha could have sensed me when I had raised Fox. This must be what it felt like to be struck by lightning, but without the pain. I felt the magic gather around the rune before dipping into the mound, and I felt it burrow deep into the hill's center. But this was different. When I raised Fox, it had felt right. Here, hovering on the edges of Lady Michaela's magic, my mind brushed against something foul and putrid to my senses, a stench of thought rather than of smell. The Bezoar blazed up and crumbled abruptly into dust, until no trace of it remained. The creature burst through the mound, roaring in rage. It was a hideous beast, a hodgepodge of animal parts sewn together to form one body. It was the size of a large bull, fat and corpulent, and its head a cross between a badger and a lion, with the latter's mane. Its legs were as long and as limber as a stag's, and its hooves were cloven. It turned toward us, froth dripping from jaws that widened to fold its face nearly against its ears. It bore no gums, only teeth that took up the width of its mouth, sharp and ridged. Any allure it might have possessed was in its eyes, which resembled silver gemstones striped with red. It howled, and the sound was terrifyingly human. I remembered the Asha's warning too late. Perhaps it had sensed that I was the weakest of its prey, for it came stumbling out of its grave with its eyes already trained on me, and I froze. It crooned. There was something hideously seductive about its ruby-like gaze on mine, and as much as I wanted to run away, I remained rooted to the spot, unable to move. The beast bounded toward me, but Fox stepped forward, placing himself between us. His sword was leveled at its body. Unfazed, the beast snarled and leaped forward until it was almost on top of him. "That is enough!" I felt Lady Michaela release the energy she had been holding at bay around the rune, directing it toward the creature. The spell wove itself around the Deva, stretching tight like a rope to bind the Deva where it stood. The thing stumbled, its ugly snout inches away from Fox's face. Its roar was cut short, and for several moments, it wavered. Fox did not back away and stared stonily back. Its jaws closed. The creature took a hesitant step backward. "Kneel," Lady Michaela commanded, her voice soft. The monster dropped to its haunches. It bowed its head. "Let her go." I sank to the ground, shuddering, able to move again.
"Amazing,"
Fox said, lowering his blade.
"It is a Tauravi," Michaela said, "swift as the wind, and it sings a splendid lullaby. The Bezoar in its stomach is worth more than what a popular atelier can make in many years. That is also how it entices its victims. It paralyzes them, keeping them immobile and docile before it swallows them whole.
Return to your grave."
The fight had gone out of the Tauravi. It was almost meek as it slunk back into the mound it had sprung from. It yawled only once. A thin, almost beseeching cry, like a young girl's.
Die. The Asha's voice was cold and grim. The creature died. It collapsed into the hole it had climbed out of as soon as the word left Lady Michaela's lips. The woman approached the beast, her knife at the ready. 4 quick slashes at its midsection, and a bright yellow bezoar lay in the palm of her hand. The creature turned to ash almost as soon as she retrieved the stone. Lady Michaela pulled her cloak closer around herself and sighed. Take the shovel from the saddlebags, Fox. Return the mound to the same state it was in when we first arrived.
I'm sorry. I was still shivering. The sudden disappearance of the spell around us had a strange effect on me. I wanted more of it to linger. More of it to sample. Fox placed an arm around me, and I leaned into him, grateful.
You were not in too much danger.
Lady Michaela lifted the Tawri's bezoar up, admiring the way it sparkled against the light.
But it is a good lesson for you to learn. I trust that you will be more cautious next time.
Next time? I echoed weakly.
Why did you take that stone from its stomach?
Fox asked as he shifted earth into the empty hole in the ground.
Deva were created by the False Prince with death magic so complicated that not even Asha today know how to recreate them. They were born dead, and even dormant, the dark constantly replenished their bones. The 5 great heroes discovered the means to kill the Deva, and slew 6 of the 7. Yet, every few years, they must be forcibly raised, divested of their bezoars, and sent back to their graves. For Tawri, harvest time means visiting this mound once every 10 years. There is an Akvan 100 leagues away in Donoris's Sea of Skulls that must be put down in 4 years' time. And along the Keon borders, one must retrieve a green stone from the tail of a Nangate every 7 years. Their bezoars slowly decay as the day of their resurrection draws near. And when they disappear, the creatures rise. And we repeat this cycle all over again. It is important that we raise them within a specific time frame. 7 days before they revive, at the least. They are dormant before that and do not respond even to the dark. Dig this grave a year from now, and it will carry no trace of bone. Dig it a week before today, and you will find a complete body.
And if you do not raise them,
Fox said slowly,
they will climb out of their tombs at the peak of their strength and kill again, as one killed me.
Michaela nodded. A Savul, I believe. Sakmeet was in charge of it. She is a dark Asha who lives in Estera. We have no word of her. And I fear the worst. The only way to kill them again is to rip the bezoar from their bodies. A messy endeavor, even for an average Asha. The False Prince's final curse is a heavy burden.
You say the great heroes killed 6 of the Deva. What of the 7th?
The Azi. The fiercest and most powerful of the Deva, eluded even them. No one knows where its mound lies. It is the most reclusive of the beasts, and has not been seen for many millennia. And you do all this? Was this to be my responsibility as well? The thought terrified me. I have been doing this for close to 15 years. Other Asha, death seekers, and those skilled enough in the magical arts can slay these creatures, though with more difficulty. Only bone witches can control them long enough to deprive them of their bezoars. The people of Odalia may not like us, child, but a reason for their dislike is having to be beholden to us.
Michaela tucked the topaz-hued stone into her waist pouch.
And in exchange,
we acquire priceless ingredients. Mix the bezoar with elderbark juice and mushroom tart, and you also have an antidote for consumption.
The effects of the spell Lady Michaela had woven, combined with the strange paralysis I suffered, still lingered in me. While I had not liked my first brush with the creature, the magic the Aja used to contain it had not been unpleasant. My fingers twitched, and I reached out without thinking, seeking for remnants of the magic that remained, and felt the full force of Michaela's will bearing down on my mind. The Aja was forcing me to draw in more magic than I could handle. The pleasure so great it was almost painful.
Let go.
Only to find myself abruptly cut off and on the ground before I could move.
It will always feel good, Lady Michaela said softly. At least at first. But the more you draw in such a short time, the harder it will be to put up barriers in your mind, until all you will concern yourself with is drawing more power until you die from the dark rot. It is an addiction that many bone witches could not overcome, and that is why we are so few in number. I compelled you the way I compelled the creature to show you the consequences of taking in too much, of letting your guard down and allowing someone else an opening to take over. In time, I will teach you control. I will teach you restraint. I will decide the next time you can draw the rune again, and it will be different.
You put her in danger,
Fox accused, dropping to his knees beside me. I could sense the anger in his thoughts. I slew a fellow sister witch once when I was younger. The Deva took her over, and there was no other choice. I am ruthless now because I have no intention of doing so ever again.
Harshness took the place of the Asha's melodious voice.
Do you understand me, Tia?
Yes, I breathed, squeezing Fox's hand in reassurance, my mind clearer. Lady Michaela was telling me the reason bone witches were feared. Not because we could control Deva, but because Deva were not the only ones we could choose to compel.
Did you like Neve? I asked. The girl sat and stared at the ocean from underneath the bones of a monster long dead, for there is a reason they call this place the Sea of Skulls. Water swirled around her ankles and stained the bottom of her dress the color of rusted blood. The skeletal monster loomed above her, its remains an arc against the hot sun that scorched the black earth around them. I remembered the elephant-like Deva she had slain mere feet from where I stood, staring out at the world through unseeing eyes, with loops of viscera halfway out its stomach. I held my breath, but no foul odors wafted from the spot. No flies buzzed from where its carcass used to lie. Despite the blazing heat, I could see no maggots combing the earth for flesh. Only the bones from other monsters remained. Dead monuments, offerings to the sea. No. I found the people strange. I found them suspicious of all those who don't look or act like them. Doubtless they held the same opinions of me, but for the opposite reason. You came from Dricht. You understand full well the tyranny of the old guard, the inflexibility of the ruling class. The bourgeois of Neve entertain more liberties. A Drichta might kill an Asha and believe it only follows the will of gods. A Neven will claim the higher ground and preach clemency, but kill when no one else sees. The runeberry trade influenced Mirkwick's beliefs, but the rest of Odalia takes its cues from its capital city. Even Knight's Cross. But the world will always look different when you open your eyes to what you previously refused to see. It was the same for you, wasn't it? When King Adil outlawed the songs that made you famous everywhere else, and they took you from your mother's house to languish in his dungeons for 3 months? How did you know that? From above us, the skeletal beast watched, knowing. She gestured at my heart's glass, at the colors that ebbed in and out of view. She smiled. You are easy enough to read. I did not like Neve, but entering that city for the first time remains one of the strangest and most exhilarating experiences of my life. Perhaps because everything felt so new. Perhaps because I was realizing how much wider the world was than the Knight's Cross-shaped one I had occupied. I never got over my dislike of crowds, though I have performed before them hundreds of times. I never liked being the center of attention, which is unusual for an Asha. But despite the people's aversion to us, I had fond memories of my first night in Neve. Why is that? In my life, I have only ever been attracted to two men. And what is even more unusual was that I met both that very same night in Neve, though not in the best circumstances.
5. Neve was the capital of Odalia, and a celebration was in progress when Lady Michaela guided us through the winding streets, she riding on her Palomino and Fox riding behind me on the gray Dapple she'd purchased in Mirkwick. I had never seen so many people packed together in so small a space before. Knight's Cross constructed its houses according to the natural paths of the land, so I was used to broad roads. I've lived in Keon for many years, but I've never grown used to the narrow, constrained lanes of busy cities like Odalia. Adding to the feeling of close confinement are the groups of people who have gathered to watch noisy bands of musicians cavorting through the streets, dressed in confusing swirls of clothing and color. Some carried tambourines, while others chose drums or trumpets. All were not shy about making as much noise as possible. People built small fires around the city square and took turns leaping over them while others watched and applauded, laughing. The sight of those flames, coupled with the smallness of the spaces and the largeness of the crowds, alarmed me. I clung to my brother, fearful that the fires might spread, that parts of the city might burn before long. Despite the heat and the smoke surrounding us, his skin was cold to the touch.
They celebrate the spring equinox,
Fox said as boys and girls alike leapfrogged over the pyres, daring each other to jump higher at every turn.
Fire is a cleansing tool, and to leap over it is to clean themselves of all sickness and evil in anticipation of the coming year.
But we don't do this in Knight's Cross. The closest thing we have to a large fire was my family's forge, and I could only imagine his reaction should the villagers elect to jump over it.
Farmland is not an appropriate venue for fire building, Tia.
I'm not sure cities are made the same way. The festivities quieted somewhat when we passed. People stopped to stare at Lady Michaela's empty heart's glass, and then at the silver tints of mine. They tried to melt back into the crowd, to give us room, though the paths were small and gave them difficulty. Fox received a few of those stares for his lack of heart's glass and for the plain silver sword at his hip, as none of the revelers wore weapons that I could see. Not for his absence of shadow, I tried to convince myself, and certainly not because they knew he was dead. Neve was nothing like Knight's Cross. It may seem ridiculous to imagine I could compare the two, but Knight's Cross was all I'd ever known. And not even my books prepared me for the shock of the city. My village was simple and muted against a backdrop of forests and stone, where the forge and the gossip were the noisiest sounds. But the city of Neve wore its people for emphasis, like giant exclamation marks that walked in every street and loitered at every corner. Its citizens attired themselves in bright and stunning dresses that called to the eyes. None of the women back home wore veils. It would be an awkward garment to wear when working in the fields. Some of the Neven women wore these loosely about their persons, and others wore them coiled so tightly about their heads that I could not tell the color of their hair or even if they had any. A few took this a step further. They had on masks and long, flowing robes that hid everything but their eyes. Many of the people's faces were smooth and polished, at times prettier and handsomer than they first appeared. It felt to me that there was something strange about their features. They were a little too refined and a little too contrived. Like a whetstone had given them precision, but also left them too sharp for nature to allow for. To my eyes, it was like each person wore two faces that shared the exact same space, one pressing down on top of the other, one too pretty and affected to be natural, and the other too flawed and regular to be artificial.
"Glamour," Lady Michaela said over her shoulder without looking up from her book. I would later learn that it was her habit to read as she walked and read as she rode. She had given me a book from her collection so I could do the same, but I was unused to riding horses, and sore buttocks soon distracted me from turning the pages.
"The smallest of magics. Harmless, for the most part. It allows the people their vanities. But we Asha can see them all the same." We rode past colorful banners and vibrant pinions. The marketplace was awash with sights and smells, from the fresh, minty scent of potted plants to the tantalizing aroma of fried foods and baking bread that reminded my stomach I'd had nothing but a strip of beef jerky in the last few hours. Signs calling for prosperity and luck graced every door. Carts wheeled by, and children raced past older folk, who bore armfuls of clothes and baskets. Occasionally a carriage would pass, too rich and ornate for its inhabitants to give us more than a second glance. I expected Lady Michaela to make for the harbor. She had told me that the fastest way to Kion was to take a ship from the port of Adalia in Neve, as opposed to the month-long journey it would take on land. When she rode past the street leading down the row of ships anchored at the dock and onto the road leading to the Odalian castle, I was surprised.
"We shall stay at the palace for the night, at King Telamane's request," the Asha said. "It is the spring equinox, and I draw heart's runes for the children in Neve every year. We'll leave at first light tomorrow and catch the earliest ship to Kion. Speak up, Fox. I can see the question on your face."
"I do not mean to cause offense, mistress. But many Odalians consider it bad luck to offer bone witches a place to stay, even for a night. For the ruler of Odalia to do so would be disastrous in their eyes. How did you manage to convince the king?"
"It was his idea. The royal chancellor and the palace steward have been taken into his confidence, albeit reluctantly, and no one else is aware of our housing arrangements."
She smiled faintly.
"And in case you wondered, no, I did not compel him to do it. Drawing heart's rune for so many at once is a tedious task, but I do it in gratitude to His Majesty."
I wasn't sure what to think of the king I deemed responsible for Fox's death, but my brother only shrugged and said that it was a soldier's life. And if they blamed the king for every cut and kill and death that they take, there would be no army left in all the kingdoms.
"But wouldn't that be better?"
I asked as we dismounted. Stable hands from the royal stable hurried forward to take the horse's reins.
"No armies would mean no war."
Fox laughed suddenly, though his chest did not rise and fall.
"Silly girl. You are not yet an Asha, and you already understand the games kings and queens play. I certainly don't."
The castle was open to all who came at this time of year, because, like the spring equinox, this was the custom. The people wore magic on their brows. They painted their lips scarlet with the spell's fullness and dusted their cheeks with its rouge. I could feel the enchantments woven into their clothes. Lady Michaela took her time pointing out some of the spells to me, so I could commit to memory how they looked and what they felt like. Many arranged elegance in their feather bonnets and solemnity in their tailcoats. composure adorned a lady's majestic hat. It didn't work on me. The overabundance of feathers made her look like she had assaulted an ungainly duck in a past life and wore its skin. And the thought made me giggle.
Why do they do that?
I asked Michaela.
Why do they waste magic this way?
It is the way of the rich, she replied, shrugging one silk-clad shoulder. They commission the ateliers to spin it into their clothes and call it fashion, or have apothecaries paint their faces and call it beauty. You are village-born and do not understand the way the city's mind works. The city rich are not like bees in a hive that work together to share honey for all. The city rich are like the jungle apes. They show off their red bottoms and beat their chests because they fear to be culled from the herd if they show weakness. Even the most inferior of runeberries can suffice for this magic. So we let them be.
Is that why you don't wear magic like they do?
Lady Michaela grinned at me. But I am wearing magic, little one. The difference is that it is woven so finely into my hue that you cannot detect it. The people in this part of the city recognized her, too, and gave us a wider berth. I walked through the crowd with my head down, the ground suddenly more interesting to study than people. Lady Michaela was used to the silence, and walked with her head thrown back and a secret smile on her lips. Fox brought up the rear, and paid no attention when those standing closest shrunk back. The king and his son stood at the castle gates, welcoming visitors. King Telamane was a large man of unexpected height. It was easier to imagine him in the smoke of battle or in the aftermath of a bloody duel, not dressed in rich satin robes of dyed purple, with a crown two sizes too small for his head. He had a great black beard clumped against his chin to hide a thin, nearly lipless mouth, and bright green eyes that were more shrewd than clever. His heart's glass was built to size, twice as large as my own, but adequate when framed against his massive chest. Beside him was a young boy a year or two older than me, wearing a smaller crown in his father's eyes. But where King Telamane's eyes were a hard and opaque jade, his son's were deep and gentle emeralds that smiled back despite his serious face. He was easily the most handsome boy I'd ever met. When he caught me staring, I looked away, frantically willing my blush to fade.
Lady Michaela.
The king stepped forward, large hands folding over one of the ashes and hiding it from everyone's view.
Thank you for coming, as always.
It is my pleasure, as always. There is a good crowd here. How many hearts glass are present?
480 in all.
I started. In Knight's Cross, it would be a good year if there were more than 20 13-year-olds for the equinox. We have even less reason to delay then. The night grows old. This is my apprentice, Tia Pahlavi, and her brother Fox.
I am enchanted.
King Telamane was an experienced statesman. The faintest spasm of orange flickered across his heart's glass, but only for the briefest second. I felt an irrational surge of resentment and forgot my embarrassment.
No, you aren't.
Both King Telamane and Michaela turned to me. The man was curious and the Asha cautioning. I could understand his disinterest of yet another bone witch in his kingdom, but Fox was a different matter.
My brother died. You told him where. And he went like a good soldier to fight and got nothing but a coffin for his troubles. Surely he deserves more than your indifference.
I gave his heart's glass a pointed glance.
Even if it is well concealed.
Some of those in his retinue gasped, alarmed by my frankness. Lady Michaela said nothing. The king threw his head back, revealed two rows of square white teeth to everyone present, and laughed aloud.
Such spirit in this one! You've chosen well, Michaela. She'll grow your fangs soon enough.
She shows much promise, Lady Michaela murmured,
She seems to have learned to read heart's glass with little training.
King Telamain turned to Fox.
I am grateful for the services you rendered your kingdom, young man. And I am sorry for the situation that finds you here. I shall talk to my stewards and ensure that your family will want for nothing. It is small compensation, but it is the least I can do.
You are too kind, Your Majesty.
Fox bowed.
It was a bad business. I remember that order. But I had little choice. I could not afford to have my northern borders terrorized by some nameless creature. We never did find the Deva. But my men must have injured it, for the attacks ceased soon after. What are the chances of it slinking off to whatever lair it calls its own to die?
With much respect to Your Majesty,
Fox said, with his usual gravity.
I hope it did not.
The king laughed even harder.
I see that you have your hands full with these siblings, Michaela. Fire and calm, these two. Water and flash. Much like my sons. This is Prince Kantz.
The boy smiled at me, and I felt my cheeks prickle with heat again.
It is my honor to meet you, Aja.
He bowed low, and his heart's glass swung with a movement. Like his father's, it was set in silver and adorned with an intricate working of the royal family crest along its edges. A lion's silhouette emblazoned against the sun.
I'm not an Aja, I stammered. How could a simple smile work such wonders to my heart? I'm...
An apprentice, Lady Michaela interrupted, taking pity on me. Due to take up her novitiate in Ankyo.
But a bone witch all the same, eh?
The king winked at me.
It has been a rare year. The first new bone witch in decades. Two of you from Odalia, when many other kingdoms are forced to do without. Doesn't Estera only have that one old crone left, Michaela? Of course, we don't have Keon's heart forger, but he's old and getting on in years.
Heart forger? I asked before I could stop myself. King Telamain gestured at my heart's glass with a thick hand.
Their heart's glass are silver white, like yours. But they don't wave magic about like you do. Only fire up memories and forge them into new ones.
Two others approached the king. One a royal counselor, judging from the robes he wore, and the other a young boy in a brown cloak and hood. I read the blue and yellow palpitations on the older man's heart's glass, an irregular heartbeat of fright. The others was easier to discern. His was beat red with anger, directed at us. I didn't bother to look at their faces, keeping my eyes on the counselor's heart's glass instead.
Your Majesty,
he stuttered.
We shouldn't keep the children waiting.
Cannot spend so much time on those witch folk.
The man's heart's glass seemed to whisper.
What would the people think, seeing their king consorting with these pariahs?
He is right. Lady Michaela laid a firm hand on my arm. We had best get started. 480 children are waiting. Kings and queens may be let off with ungracious behavior, she murmured once we were alone again. Bone witches may not. Speak in that manner to the king or to anyone else in the palace, and I will box your ears and have you clean the city outhouses for a month. We are welcomed in most of Odalia because of his generosity, and are outcasts without.
I promise,
I said meekly. Because Lady Michaela was the kind who carried out anything she threatened, if our time at the Deva Mound was any indication.
What did he mean by heart forgers?
She tapped at my heart's glass. A different magic, but with the same color. They're of more use to the people than bone witches, so they aren't as reviled. They can take memories and break them into bits and pieces, distill them down into potions and spells, and build them back up into new hearts, bright and counterfeit,
so that even we can't tell one heartbeat from the other. Fortunately, some artificial hearts cost more than a kingdom, and so few people bother.
But why?
For noble reasons and for horrible reasons. Give your heart to the wrong person and they can abuse that trust. And there are spells to prevent you from drawing one anew. When you have enough enemies, it is sometimes necessary to speed up what nature did not intend. The strongest spells require memories. There are many people who wish to forget. And there are many rich enough to pay for the privilege.
But that's terrible!
People can be terrible, Tia.
Lady Michaela's empty heart's glass winked against the light as she turned away. And I wondered what in the Asha's past was responsible for making her so sad. Only one Asha was necessary for the equinox ritual. So I stood aside, watching from the sidelines while Lady Michaela attended to her task. As her apprentice, I was given a spot among the most junior of the king's staff, on the edges of the crowd but able to watch the proceedings without looking over everyone else's heads. Fox, not quite as fortunate, stood somewhere in the middle of the group. It did not matter. I could feel him there, and that was enough. We were part of a large audience looking on, where at the center of the town square, a group of children around my age stood expectantly. They were dressed in their prettiest and most expensive clothes and held their empty heart's glass in their hands. After presenting themselves to the king, the boys and girls waited as Lady Michaela moved down the line, tracing runes as she went. Each heart's glass case seemed to me even more elaborate than the next. I could feel poise and composure incantations woven into the dress of one girl, so that the crowd marveled even as she fidgeted and squirmed in her lace and satin best. One boy dug a finger into his nose with undue diligence, the spells on him muting the action. It was simpler back in Knight's Cross, I thought. We were too poor to afford but to behave. Behind me, a chorus sang, and instruments were played by unseen hands. Lady Michaela continued, fingers working at the air, and the people watched, their faces enchanted to hide their disdain of the Bone Witch, to all but those who can see through the magic and through them.
They say you can bring back the dead.
I looked behind me. A boy stood there, his hostility obvious.
They say you can bring back the dead,
he repeated.
Well, can you?
Most of the people in Neve had gone out of their way to ignore me, so his pointed derision took me by surprise. It depends. Do you require raising? It did not appear to be the answer the boy wanted.
Can you or can't you?
A black cloak many sizes too big swallowed him up, hid his heart's glass from my view. I could not see the color of his hair. Could only see the lower half of his face and one of his eyes, which was hooded in gray. If only I could see his heart, I thought, and tell whether he had reasons to be smug or whether he was merely stupid. At least he did not smell of spells and invocations, none woven into his clothes to mask his disgust. I'm a bone witch. Of course I can.
My father says bone witches are demon children.
The boy persisted.
They curse the healthy and blight the sane. No other magic would touch them because they sell their hearts to the dark. That's how they raise dead men, soulless as they are.
Bone witches do not sell their hearts. The boy's eyes narrowed.
Because you have no hearts to give, the lot of you. So you take others for your own and bleed them dry. You grow the dead by the armies, and if we don't keep you in check, you will let them overrun us.
That's not true! I grew angrier with every word. I had done nothing for the boy to single me out. You hate us for nothing more than prejudice. The boy pulled his cloak even tighter around himself.
I know your tricks. My father told me all about your kind. If you can't see my heart's glass, then you can't curse me.
I don't want to curse you.
That was only half the truth, because I was angry and did wish I knew how to shut him up. From inside his hood, the boy's face hardened.
Your kind killed my mother,
he snapped. He turned and fled back into the confines of the crowd, but not before his heavy cloak shifted and I saw his heart's glass. It blazed back at me for an instant, a bright-tipped, shimmering silver, and then it was gone, lost in the maze of people. And the boy along with it.
She had changed her hue in the interim. This time it was of a deep blue, to mimic the depths of the sea. A pattern of waves made up half of the dress before tapering off as it drifted downward, speckled in areas with orange-colored carp and silver-backed trout. The dragon was again a prominent design here, but parts of its body remained hidden behind her waist wrap, which was tinted in turquoise and overlaid with peach and gray seashells, so only its head and front legs stuck out. Its eyes were made of black agate, and they peered out at me, with its disproportioned snout raised, tusks on display. Its hind legs jutted out at the bottom of the thick wrap, tail ending in a long, sharp spike. To complement her hua, she wore an assortment of jeweled pins on her hair, commonly seen in royal courts. The gems dangled from long sticks pushed into her hair, braided and secured by silk bands and fashioned from aquamarine and fire opal beads. I have made 28 visits to the Ankyo Oracle. This announcement piqued my curiosity. I was aware of the Ankyo Oracle's importance to the Asha of the Willows, but the women are only required to visit her for the most important matters. When she begins a relationship with a patron, for example, or when she pledges service to a king or noble. The average Asha makes only 2 visits to the temple during her time as an apprentice, she said, sensing my next question. The first to present herself, when she comes to take up residence at the Willows, and the second when she is about to debut as a full-fledged Asha. Until she finds a benefactor, she is no longer required to announce herself to the Oracle. Unfortunately, the Oracle had something very different in mind with me.
6. Where Neve was a closed city of shuttered trade, Ankyo, the capital of Kion, was a flourishing cornucopia of open spaces and color. It was a kingdom made up of other kingdoms, invaded by one or the other at different times in history, before finally breaking away and achieving independence on its own terms. But such influences remained, from the severe-looking headscarves worn by some that were reminiscent of Drift, to the cylindrical top hats favored by men from the Yadosha city-states, to the multiple inclined roofs of the houses here, distinctive in Arankoshan and Denorian architecture. The roads were wider, which I preferred, and most of the houses were simpler in design. No more than small square structures with white walls and angled roofs. The Odalian capital was a colorful place, where people showed off their silks and jewelry, and many Kions made up for their simple homes with elaborate wardrobes. I didn't know how I wasn't constantly tripping over cloths and hems, for the people favored heavier garments as much for fashion statements as for the colder seasons. Long trains of satin trailed behind the women, coupled with yards of sleeves of intricate designs that hung from their elbows or spilled down from their waists, imitating the Asha's traditional hua. Headscarves were not as common in Ankyo as in Neve, but every now and then, I spotted a covered head among the crowds. Many here chose to wear their hair loose, or had elaborately coiffed hairstyles that sported as many as 3 or 4 gemstone ornaments. The men wore less than the women, but the designs stitched into their long tunics and overcoats covered every inch of space, elaborate to the point of fastidiousness. There was no surface on their clothes that did not have embroidery or patterns or motifs of paisley and crests in some way. 2 or 3 layers of clothing appeared to be the standard, and Lady Michaela's beautiful hue suited the Kion fashion perfectly. And if the magic the Odalians wore had been enough to make my head spin, the spells here nearly forced me to my knees. Waves of it emanated from nearly every person we passed, and the world spun. I swayed in my saddle, and only Fox's quick thinking kept me from falling off my horse. "Take these." Lady Michaela was beside me in a moment, offering me two jeweled pins like the one she wore in her hair. One was a curved accessory set with beautiful star sapphires, and the other was plainer, shaped like a strangely gnarled crescent moon, and wrapped in silver wire and amethyst. "Pin these to your hair." The dizziness abated when I put them on. I could still feel the magic roaring around me, but it felt strangely muted, and no longer hurt my eyes or my mind. "A countermeasure," the Ajah explained. "Do not let the simplicity of our city fool you. Kions take their love of magic to an even greater extreme than Odalians do."
"Is it always like this?" It seemed offensive to me somehow. How people wasted their magic this way, when the villagers in Mirkwick struggle to make even Runeberry Patch count.
"There is a reason they call Ankyo the City of Plenty, Tia. Most Kions are rich, which also means they can't help themselves."
Kion castles were different in structure from Odalian castles. They were smaller in size but boasted multiple floors, each layer marked by a bowed rooftop, thinner than the ones in the Kingdom of Denoris, but less ornate than those of Aran Kosho. The result was not unlike several tiers of sugared cake piled atop one another, with pointed spires on every corner curling up into the sky. But this time, Lady Michaela ignored the palace and turned to a small district nearby and into another world entirely. The houses here were not as small and as square as most of the city, but longer and more rectangular in form, the size of two or three average Ankyan houses. The walls facing the street were made of thick adobe and white brick, plain and devoid of any other design.
"We call this the Willows," Lady Michaela said. "Home to the greatest Asha in all the kingdoms."
"There aren't any willows,"
Fox said, who sometimes took things literally.
"Here is one."
And Lady Michaela placed a hand on my shoulder. She led us to one house in particular. Only a peculiar symbol painted on a wooden sign out front distinguished it from several others along that same street. Beyond the initial doorway was a long strip of corridor that led into the inner rooms. The Asha paused at a spot where the cobbled ground ended, and the carefully tamped down earthen floor I would learn was common in all Ashaka began. She took off her shoes and placed them in a small wooden cubicle built for that purpose, and signaled for us to do the same. The narrow passageway continued into an airy room that was both a reception hall and a transition place between the rest of the rooms and the street outside. Thick rugs of beautiful geometric designs lined the walls, and the floor was similarly covered with a thinner, less intricate carpet. The ceiling was higher than I had anticipated, with sloping curves that formed a hollowed-out dome at its center. A small screen stood at the farthest end of the room, preventing visitors from seeing the inner chambers within, and a towering flower display was arranged on a table before it. A steel coal brazier lay in one corner, blazing merrily. Two people rose to meet us as we entered. The first was a very old woman, her skin stretched so tautly over her bones that she looked nearly like a skeleton herself. Her hair was completely white and carefully set against the back of her skull in a severe bun. She reminded me of an aged Tamra cat's, with her triangularly shaped face and pointed chin. Her cheeks were sunken in, but her eyes were a bright and intelligent green. She wore a hua even more elegant and elaborate than Lady Michaela's. It was an abstract design of pale amber against a deep brown background, and an olive-green waist wrap with actual emeralds sewn into the gold-embroidered silk, matching the color of her eyes.